becomes the issue again. And that explains why Rodolfo Hernández, in part, gained so many votes. It's the fact that people want to vote against the establishment because there are very few and very small avenues to act politically otherwise.
So you're saying that it could be that they just won't join together to beat Petro and Marquez. Finally, we just have 20 seconds. But how dangerous is this for Petro and Marquez? Some of their speeches they give behind bulletproof shields. They've had death threats against them.
Absolutely. Extremely dangerous to them. Extremely dangerous to everybody in the whole country. There was an armed strike by paramilitary forces throughout half of the country. This is linked to the armed forces. Yes, it's dangerous for them, for everybody. We all live, including Francia and Gustavo, under constant death threats and under a state of genocide.
We have to leave it there. We will continue to follow this, of course. Manuel Rosenthal, Colombian physician, activist, part of Pueblos and Camino, People on the Path. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Angie Caron. Welcome back to Torino Nudura. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Street Books, Revelry in the Park Book Celebration, and 12th Summer Season Kickoff on Monday, June 6th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the South Park Blocks in Portland. Street Books is celebrating their 12th summer season of providing bicycle-based library books and community to those living outside in the Portland area. Street Books is accepting donations of reading glasses, coloring books, graphic novels, and art supplies. Again, that's Street Books Revelry in the Park Book Celebration and 12th Summer Season Kickoff on Monday, June 6th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the South Park Blocks between Southwest Jefferson and Southwest Madison in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene. Join hosts Patrick Picard, Barbara LaMorticella, and Walt Curtis for Talking Earth on the second and third Mondays of each month from 10 to 11 p.m. More information can be found on kboo.fm under schedule.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, gas prices in Oregon reach another record high as crude oil costs soar. New federal lawsuits are filed against law enforcement and the city of Portland for actions during the 2020 racial justice protests. And Hillary Clinton campaign lawyer Michael Sussman is acquitted of lying to the FBI in a case brought by a Trump-era prosecutor. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 31st, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. New federal civil rights lawsuits have been filed in recent days, alleging a litany of offenses by federal and local law enforcement during the 2020 racial justice protests in Portland. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Three federal civil rights lawsuits filed recently highlight a list of alleged offenses by both federal and local law enforcement during 2020 racial justice protests in Portland. The lawsuits, which come as the two-year statute of limitations deadline approaches, describe multiple violations of protesters' First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment rights. They involve alleged enforced disappearances, retaliation, assault, battery, and negligence. Evelyn Bossie alleges federal law enforcement agents abducted her from a downtown street on July 15, 2020, as she was leaving a protest at the federal courthouse. After driving around for a few minutes, officers searched Bossie before ultimately concluding she did not fit the description of the person they were looking for. Her complaint says the agents never said who they were. Bossie is suing the four unknown Department of Homeland Security officers who detained her, their unknown supervisors, and regional and national leadership of the Federal Protective Services, Customs and Border Protection, and U.S. Marshals Service at the time of the incident. She says she has struggled to eat and sleep and was ultimately diagnosed and treated for acute post-traumatic stress disorder. Bossie's detention was recorded by a witness. It happened the same night federal law enforcement used similar tactics to remove Mark Pettibone from a downtown street. Pettibone told Oregon Public Radio at the time that officers did not identify themselves, pulled his beanie over his face, and drove around before finally letting him out in the parking garage of the Mark O. Hatfield Federal Courthouse. The incident sparked national outrage and led to numerous investigations. In another complaint filed last week, Megan Oproek alleges Portland Police Bureau officers, under Detective Eric Kammerer's leadership and acting within city policy, fired a rubber ball distraction device at her on June 25, 2020. She was walking away from police in the direction they had ordered her and other protesters to go. The lawsuit also names the city of Portland, alleging senior leaders in the police bureau and Mayor Ted Wheeler knew about and approved the crowd control weapons being used and the policies governing their use. Oproek suffered a concussion, has required ongoing medical treatment, and has scars from the incident, according to their lawsuit. Finally, Tyler Ventilius filed a lawsuit against the city of Portland, Kammerer, and 10 unnamed officers. It alleges Kammerer's June 26, 2020 use of force against him was excessive and part of a pattern in practice of Portland police officers targeting people protesting against the police. The lawsuit states, quote, Kammerer attacked not because he had probable cause, but because he wanted to make protesters hurt and because he knew he would face no discipline for doing so. This attack on protesters serves the ultimate policy goal to extrajudiciously punish protesters, end quote. The lawsuit says Ventilius never engaged in active aggression or physical resistance during the June 27, 2020 protest. Segments pulled from a video included in the filing appear to show Kammerer emerge from behind a police line and knock several protesters to the ground, including Ventilius. The lawsuit also says he suffered a traumatic brain injury as a result. In addition to the civil rights violations allegedly committed by the officers, Ventilius claims the city lacks proper supervisory review of use of force incidents. Juan Chavez, an attorney at the Oregon Justice Resource Center who is representing both Ventilius and Bossie, said in the Ventilius lawsuit the city was deliberately indifferent to Kammerer's actions. Chavez said, quote, what all these facts show is that they did have notice on oh so many fronts for years, and when it came to the fore with Ventilius, that could have been avoided a long time ago, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
European Union nations agreed late Monday to ban 90% of Russian crude oil by the end of the year. Charles Michel, president of the European Council, said the move would immediately impact 75% of Russian oil imports, with 90% being banned by the end of the year. The embargo is part of the EU's sixth sanction package on Russia since it invaded Ukraine. The embargo covers Russian oil brought in by sea, but allows for an exemption for imports delivered by pipeline after several EU nations heavily reliant on Russian oil voiced opposition to a complete ban. The Ukrainian Foreign Ministry said in a statement Tuesday it was disappointed that due to resistance from Hungary in particular, the ban took so long and makes exemptions for pipeline deliveries. Currently, roughly 36% of the EU's oil imports come from Russia. The ban could increase worries over an already tight energy market. Energy prices have soared over the past year, contributing to a heated inflationary environment in many countries. In Ukraine, Russian troops have taken positions in half of Severodonetsk, a city in Ukraine's industrial heartland of the Donbass, as Russia escalated its offensive in the region. Severodonetsk is the last major city in the Luhansk province that remains under Ukrainian control, and its seizure would boost the Russian offensive in the region. The British Defense Ministry has said Russia's encirclement of Severodonetsk and the closure of a pocket around Ukrainian forces in the Luhansk province likely remain Moscow's main goal. President Joe Biden said Monday that Washington will not supply Kyiv with rocket systems that can reach into Russia after Ukraine called for more advanced weapons as it tries to contain Russian advances in the Donbass. Biden's comments come amid reports suggesting this only rules out providing certain long-range munitions and that Washington may still be gearing up to send advanced long-range rocket systems to Ukraine. Meanwhile, the newly appointed U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Bridget Brink, arrived in Kyiv on Monday in a sign of diplomatic support as D.C. is reestablishing its presence on the ground after evacuating diplomatic staff from Ukraine amid fears of invasion. Gas prices in Oregon and across the nation have once again reached a record high this week. On Tuesday, Oregon's average price for regular gas was $5.22, up 5 cents from last week. In Portland, the average price per gallon is now $5.28. The national average rose 2 cents, up to $4.62 a gallon. The increase is driven primarily by the spike in crude oil prices. A barrel of crude oil now costs more than $116. Every state in the U.S. is now averaging more than $4 a gallon. Oregon's gas prices are the fifth highest nationwide, behind California, Hawaii, Nevada, and Washington State. California is the only state with average gas prices above $6 per gallon. Several nations, including the U.S., have placed strict sanctions on Russia, one of the world's largest producers of oil, following its invasion of Ukraine. The European Union's ban on Russian oil exports will likely further constrain global supply. Prior to this year, gas prices had peaked in the summer of 2008. Adjusted for inflation, the $4.29 per gallon record from 2008 would be about $5.76 in today's money. According to Wall Street analyst Ed Yardeni, the typical household is now spending $4,800 on gas at an annual rate, compared with $2,800 just 1 year ago. Experts say they do not see gas prices falling anytime soon, with some even predicting prices could hit $6.20 per gallon nationally by August of this year. A federal jury in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday found Hillary Clinton campaign lawyer Michael Sussman not guilty on a charge of lying to the FBI. Prosecutors from Special Counsel John Durham's office had contended that Sussman misrepresented himself during a meeting with the FBI's general counsel in 2016 in hopes of orchestrating a so-called October surprise against rival Donald Trump. The two-week trial was the first arising from Durham's three-year investigation into the origins of the Trump-Russia investigation. Sussman, a cybersecurity lawyer, provided the FBI with obscure internet data indicating a possible communications channel between computer servers associated with the Trump Organization and Alpha Bank, Russia's largest commercial financial institution. The FBI later determined Sussman's concerns were unfounded. The case centered around prosecutors' claims that Sussman told the FBI's general counsel, James Baker, during the meeting that he was passing on the information as a concerned citizen and not on behalf of any client. Prosecutors told jurors that Sussman was there on behalf of two clients, the Clinton campaign and Rodney Joffe, the technology executive who oversaw research into Alpha Bank. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's expansive report found that the Kremlin did try to intervene in the election for Trump's benefit and that Trump's campaign had numerous undisclosed contacts with Russians. However, Mueller did not find any evidence that Trump's camp conspired with the Russian government. Durham's work has led to two criminal cases besides Sussman's. A former FBI lawyer, Kevin Kleinsmith, pleaded guilty to altering an email related to secret FBI surveillance of ex-Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. He was sentenced to probation last year. In the second case, analyst Igor Danchenko is awaiting trial on a charge that he lied to the FBI in 2017. Danchenko, a Russian citizen who lives in Virginia, worked on the so-called Steele dossier, the salacious and largely unverified collection of Trump's alleged links to Russia. He's alleged to have lied when he said he told investigators he did not get any information from a Democratic operative. Trump has repeatedly touted Durham's investigation and said after Sussman and Danchenko were charged that the criminal cases, quote, really show us what a hoax it was, end quote. The federal jury determined Sussman was not guilty of lying to the FBI. A new app is helping direct Oregonians to spots along the Columbia River where the water quality is safe. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Ready to make a splash this summer? An app is helping direct Northwesterners to spots along the Columbia River where it's safe to play. Swim Guide provides conditions at popular Columbia River recreation sites using water collection data about harmful bacteria. Columbia Riverkeeper tests the water for E. coli contamination, a naturally occurring bacteria found in the intestines of mammals. Elevated levels can make people sick when it's ingested and even cause death. Lori Epstein is water quality director with the group.
E. coli is the single bacteria that we're testing for, but it's actually what's called an indicator bacteria. So if you find E. coli in the water, it's an indicator of fecal contamination in the water, which then can also indicate that you are likely to have a host of other pathogens present.
Epstein says Swim Guide is downloadable on phones or available on the website ColumbiaRiverkeeper.org. She adds other ways to stay safe while swimming this summer include rinsing off after getting out of the water, avoiding swimming with open cuts or wounds, and steering clear of industrial areas or algal blooms. Epstein says Oregon and Washington both fund monitoring of E. coli on the coastline.
That funding doesn't transfer over to the freshwater beaches along the Columbia. So that's where Columbia Riverkeeper has stepped in to try to fill that gap.
Epstein says the hope is that recreating on the Columbia River will help people feel closer to it. And the worst case is that people fear swimming or boating in the river and stay away.
Then maybe we don't care as much about what is in the river or what kind of pollution is going into it or cleaning up the river. So I think it is a really important tool for people to be able to build that relationship and connect with the river.
Epstein says other ways people can keep E. coli out of the river is by picking up after their dogs and being aware of the chemicals they send down the drain and use on their yards. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 57 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a high of 77 degrees. Today in history, in 1921, thousands of white citizens in Tulsa, Oklahoma, descended on the city's predominantly black Greenwood District, burning homes and businesses to the ground and killing hundreds of people. Long mischaracterized as a race riot rather than mass murder, the Tulsa Race Massacre stands as one of the worst incidents of racial violence in the nation's history. The quote of the day is from American author, activist, and civil rights leader Coretta Scott King, who said, quote, "Hate is too great a burden to bear. It injures the hater more than it injures the hated," end quote. U.S. senators plan a bipartisan discussion on gun reform. Ukraine's president wants to meet with his Russian counterpart. And the midterm electoral outlook looks bleak for Democrats. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We must never betray the lives laid down to make our nation a beacon to the world, a citadel of liberty and justice for everybody.
President Joe Biden stressed the importance of the Memorial Day holiday while placing a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin also spoke, honoring those who died in America's longest war.
We remember the 2,461 American service members and personnel who fell in Afghanistan. And we remember all those who still carry the wounds of that war to body and to soul.
The U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan last August was seen as chaotic, as 13 troops were killed in a suicide bombing, and the Taliban quickly overtook control of the Afghan government. Today, a bipartisan group of senators will discuss a framework for gun policy reform. The Senate is not in session, but legislators are under pressure to act in the aftermath of the Uvalde, Texas elementary school shooting. Expanded background checks and red flag laws are among the issues expected to be discussed during the virtual meeting. Meanwhile, tensions were high outside the National Rifle Association conference in Houston, less than 5 hours away from Uvalde over the weekend.
19 kids are dead!
You need a gun because you're weak!
The NRA Board of Directors voted to re-elect longtime CEO Wayne LaPierre, who opposes gun restrictions.
Over 1 million innocent Americans every year owe their lives and the lives of their loved ones to their Second Amendment rights. Taking away their right to self-defense is not the answer.
LaPierre says he favors improving mental health services and school security. The latest outlook for the 2022 midterm elections predicts Democrats in districts President Biden won by 10 to 15 points will lose their seats. According to the Cook Political Report, Republicans could gain 20 to 35 seats, and 35 Democratic-held seats are now labeled as a toss-up or worse. Now to Ukraine, where President Volodymyr Zelensky met with troops in Kharkiv, a region still partially occupied by Russian troops. Speaking through a translator, Zelensky says he wants to meet one-on-one with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
This alternative reality of his, he has been building for quite a long time, and he is still in this world of propaganda in the Russian Federation.
Meanwhile, Russian's foreign minister denied multiple reports Putin is seriously ill and has cancer. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband was arrested and charged with DUI late Saturday after a car crash in Napa. 82-year-old Paul Pelosi was released on $5,000 bond. At the time, Speaker Pelosi was across the country in Rhode Island for Brown University's commencement ceremony. She urged graduates to unite the country.
Hope remains democracy's most powerful weapon against oppression, against cynicism, against hatred.
I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eight trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The owner of a hotel in Rapid City, South Dakota, was arrested last week after a confrontation with demonstrators from the Native community. A federal court has found that South Dakota failed to provide voter registration services required under federal law. And a new suspension bridge was dedicated recently at a coastal town in Oregon. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The owner of the Grand Gateway Hotel in Rapid City, South Dakota, was arrested last week after a confrontation with demonstrators from the Native community. The Rapid City Journal reports Connie Urey was arrested Friday on 3 counts of simple assault for allegedly spraying a cleaning product on demonstrators. The group, Indian Collective, has been leading picket line boycott events at the hotel 3 times a week for the last 6 weeks. The boycott events follow comments Urey made on social media earlier this spring to ban Native Americans from the hotel. In a video from Indian Collective of Friday's event, Urey appears to approach demonstrators holding a can of Pledge and then sprays it.
You just sprayed me in the face.
Hey, Mom!
You sprayed all of us in the face.
She sprayed her in the face.
In the video, Urey also appears to spray herself with the aerosol can before walking away from the demonstrators. In a statement, Indian Collective President CEO Nick Tilson called Urey's behavior racist, violent, disgusting, and illegal. And he says the incident will be added to the federal civil rights discrimination lawsuit filed by the group in March against owners of the hotel. A federal court last week found that South Dakota failed to provide voter registration services required under federal law. Aaron Bolton reports tribes brought the lawsuit, saying it disenfranchised Native American voters.
U.S. District Court Judge Lawrence Pearsall found that South Dakota Secretary of State Steve Barnett's office failed to provide proper training to state agencies like DMVs that are required to help residents register to vote under the National Voter Registration Act. The Ogallala Sioux Tribe and Rosebud Sioux Tribe, along with tribal members, brought the suit, arguing the noncompliance with the law specifically disenfranchised indigenous voters, which make up 9% of the population. The Native American Rights Fund said the ruling removes one more barrier to vote for American Indian people in the state. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
A new suspension bridge was recently dedicated near the coastal town of Yehats, Oregon. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, the event also recognized the displacement and genocide of Native Americans in the area.
The 142-foot-long bridge replaces one destroyed by a landslide in 2015. It spans a forested grotto, which contains a statue of Amanda Dupuy, a Coos Indian forced to give up her daughter and march the craggy shores of the Alsea Sub-Agency in the 1860s. Joanne Cattell owns the land with the statue and bridge. For her, this latest piece of the Amanda Trail is the culmination of years of activism and community support. Cattell says she often feels Amanda's spirit in the grotto.
Amanda's around all the time. Many people feel the spiritual connection to her. It's a very powerful area for a lot of people. She is very much a part of everyone who's worked there. Even the construction crew from Redmond who built the bridge ended up feeling her presence.
Cattell wants people to enjoy the bridge and scenery, but also to reflect on the death and sorrow Native Americans endured during colonization. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Cowlitz Indian Tribe has announced David Barnett, the General Council Chairman, died unexpectedly over the weekend of an apparent heart attack at his home in Shoreline, Washington. The chairman served as leader of the tribe since he was elected in June 2021. Following the tribe's succession plan, the vice chair will take over duties. Services are being planned. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Last week, President Joe Biden said the U.S. would intervene militarily if China attempts to take Taiwan by force, a warning that appeared to deviate from the deliberate ambiguity traditionally held by Washington. The White House quickly downplayed the comments, saying they don't reflect a change in U.S. policy. It's the third time in recent months that Biden has said the U.S. would protect Taiwan from a Chinese attack, only to have the White House walk back those remarks. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
At a stopover in Tokyo during his Asia trip, President Biden was asked whether the United States would defend Taiwan if it were attacked. He said yes because, quote, that's the commitment we made. Actually, there is no formal commitment, unlike defense obligations in U.S. security treaties with Japan and South Korea. Biden has made the same incorrect assertion twice before, but this time it was in the context of the war in Ukraine, suggesting, but by no means confirming, what defending Taiwan might actually mean. Biden did, however, provide just enough fuel to raise questions about his adherence to previous policy based on strategic ambiguity. Let's keep in mind that U.S. presidents have supported Taiwan's defense for many years, not just by way of substantial military aid and active responses in crisis situations. Presidents are also bound by the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, which requires provision of defense assistance to Taiwan and, more importantly, defines Taiwan as a U.S. national security interest. From that perspective, Biden's comment was less consequential than it might seem. Chinese strategists would have to presume, as in the past, that attacking Taiwan would precipitate direct U.S. intervention. Some specialists argue unconvincingly that China already outguns the U.S. in the Taiwan area and can easily overwhelm U.S. naval forces seeking to defend Taiwan. These specialists even suggest that China would attack U.S. bases in Japan, as though Beijing would risk World War III to get Taiwan back. Such scenarios may be welcome in U.S. military industrial circles, but I think they vastly overstate Chinese capabilities and, most importantly, imply recklessness in their strategic planning. As for China being motivated by Putin's invasion of Ukraine, Xi Jinping has every reason to avoid launching an aggressive war on Taiwan. Though Xi would surely want to lay claim to being the Chinese leader who finally recovered Taiwan, he is rational enough to realize how militarily difficult and economically costly that would be, and how contrary to the overwhelming desires of the Taiwanese people. Therein lie the real lessons of Putin's debacle in Ukraine. The State Department walked back Biden's comment, and Biden himself insisted U.S. policy on Taiwan had not changed. Nevertheless, the Chinese responded as they had on previous occasions, accusing the U.S. of playing with fire, interfering in China's internal affairs, which means Taiwan, and violating past U.S. pledges. This comes after Xi had actually complimented Biden in their last video summit for abiding by the One China principle. All that Biden accomplished was to give the hawks in Xi's inner circle more ammunition for viewing the U.S. as a hostile and untrustworthy rival. U.S.-China tensions over Taiwan are embedded in their rivalry across the Asia-Pacific map. It is that rivalry that carries the risk of a disastrous miscalculation of each other's intentions, whether over Taiwan or some other place. China has engaged in provocative flights near Taiwan in the past year and has greatly enhanced its air and naval power in East Asia. Beijing has become increasingly assertive militarily and diplomatically in the South China Sea and in the South Pacific. China's support of Russia in the Ukraine war is far from all out, but adds to mutual mistrust. As for the U.S., it has continued Trump-era upgrades of official visits to Taiwan and military assistance, and under Biden has built coalitions dedicated to containing China. The Quad Security Dialogue, consisting of the U.S., Japan, Australia, and India. The AUKUS Partnership, Australia-United Kingdom-U.S., as a new part of NATO's mission, and now in the 13-nation so-called Indo-Pacific Economic Framework that Biden introduced in his just-completed Asia tour. All these issues intensify the U.S.-China competition and could lead to a test of strength at sea or in the air, a test that could slide into reliance on nuclear threats. Strategic ambiguity is not an ideal basis for policy on either side, for the simple reason that ambiguity can lead to miscalculations. But it has kept tense relations across the strait from leading to a blow-up. U.S.-China friction over Taiwan is bound to continue, but so long as the U.S. or Taiwan doesn't cross the red line of Taiwan's independence, and so long as Chinese leaders adhere to the policy of peaceful unification, friction will not lead to war. The U.S. needs to recalibrate its military and political relations with Taiwan to avoid the appearance of supporting Taiwan's separation, and China needs to refrain from provocative military maneuvers near Taiwan. Both countries' leaders are sane enough to understand the cost of war, and for China especially, Ukraine demonstrates not an alluring precedent, but a terrible price attacking Taiwan would likely exact. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 31st, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings.